Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
My senior producer told me you were singing Britney Spears.
I was. I love Britney. She's an icon.
What song were you singing?
Oops, I Did It Again, maybe. Oops, I think. Yeah, it's a banger.
This week, I talk with Ziwei Fumido about getting paid to write late-night TV. Y'all are in for a treat.
Just call me Ziwei.
You're like a Beyonce?
It's not that I'm a Beyonce. It's that most people feel very uncomfortable and get stressed out when they have to pronounce my name. And I like to avoid those scenarios. But it's Fumido if you want to know.
I'm Arima Khrais, and welcome to This is Uncomfortable, a podcast from Marketplace about life and how money messes with it. In this episode, I get to do one of my favorite things, which is ask someone whose work I find super fascinating a bunch of big questions about work and money. Ziwei Fumido is a comedian who does a lot of things, including a monthly live show where she performs original pop songs. And for her 9-to-5, she is a writer on Desus and Marrow on Showtime. If you haven't watched it, you should. It is hosted by Daniel Baker, a.k.a. Desus Nice, and Joelle Martinez, a.k.a. The Kid Marrow, a.k.a. The Bodega Boys. And it's not like your typical late-night show. They're not buttoned up or trying to be politically correct all the time. It almost feels like you're eavesdropping on a conversation with two funny, smart dudes chilling in their living room.
Yo, what up, New York and yes. America? It's your boys. We are back. Desus Nice.
And the Kid Marrow, the human durag.
That's right. The number one show at late night has finally,
you know what I'm saying,
returned, and we want our motherfucking corners.
That's right.
Yeah.
In the first episode, they did this really funny skit called The Greenest Book, which Ziwei wrote.
It's basically a parody of Green Book, the film that won an Oscar for ending racism.
Mm-hmm. That was great.
Bravo to them. It's satirizing, like, the idea of this film with a, you know, a racist Italian guy, like, chauffeurs around a black guy, and somehow they heal racial wounds when obviously that was not the case. The actual family from Green Book, mm-hmm. like, hated the film and, like, publicly rejected it. And it felt so surreal that I just, like, was inspired to write, like, this story of, like, what if Marrow plays it? Like, how funny would that be? And then, you know, Desus as Mahershala killed it.
From the producers of Green Book comes the story of a white man who had the courage to know a black person.
You know what? Not that bad. A little rough around the edges, but I could rock with you, my guy.
You're a cool guy yourself, you know? Despite the fact that you're, stupid
I was just aiming to write a funny sketch that, like, satirizes how someone can be racist and still hailed as, like, this racial healer as a super progressive when clearly they were not.
Like, was this always a goal of yours to break into the writer's room?
Definitely. I wouldn't say it's always my entire life. It's been a goal of mine. I think as a child, I wanted to be a pop star. And so that's probably where Pop Show and my love for Britney Spears comes from. But definitely, once I did this internship at Comedy Central when mm-hmm. I was like 20 years old, my junior summer, and I got a joke on Colbert Report, and I was like, oh my goodness, I had no idea that, like, people could make a living being creative. You know, mm-hmm. I have these staunch Nigerian immigrant parents who really wanted me to be a doctor, like, going into finance. And so I had no idea that you could do this for a living.
Now I'm just curious. So your parents came over here. Why did they come here?
There was a civil war.
That thing.
Oh, you know, casual. Okay. Do you feel bad asking now that I said that?
No. Well, my family were also, like, refugees, so.
Shout out.
I get
shout
it.
Out,
you know
shout out. Yeah. Bleak.
Yeah. And, okay, so.
Pivot. Change the topic. Okay, let's stop talking about dying people, dying brown people.
All right, let's change the topic. Okay, so when you got your joke on the Colbert Report, did you, like, text your parents and tell them?
No, they don't care. They have no idea what I do for a living, and they don't know who Stephen Colbert is.
Really?
Really? Yes.
So they wanted you to become a doctor or pursue a more traditional field?
Definitely didn't want me to be a comedian. I remember recently telling my mother that I was like performing comedy, and she was like, "You're a comedian? No, you're not. You're a child of God." Oh. Just to give you like some sort of like inclination as to what exactly
right, just
is
to paint the
on.
Picture.
Yeah, to paint the photo. It is. It's different. It's just culturally different. They don't understand what I do.
I mean, yeah,
I'm cool with that.
Right. No, I understand that. I feel like my parents were very similar. Exactly.
So they didn't
and they're
want
like,
to see their
we
kid
didn't
fail.
Come to the U.S. for you to just
exactly
like, have fun.
100%.
Yeah.
Like all the sacrifices they made, and I want to tell jokes in the back of Union Hall. You know, like I get it. I understand.
Wait, let's talk about money. So, how would you describe your relationship with money?
I'm not rich, so horrible. Mm-hmm. I wish I was. I really wish that I was born of the trust fund. That would have been nice.
That would be
that
nice.
Been nice. Yeah. Kid.
Who would
I,
you
wish.
Be?
I wish. I mm-hmm. wish I was screwed. Colonization is honestly what got me, because my grandfather was a chief, but you know the Brits really screwed up Nigeria.
Wow.
Yeah. So to think I could have been the heir to a Nigerian throne.
Actually, though. So you would describe your relationship as horrible.
I mean, yes.
Does it stress you out?
Does money stress me out? Not as much as it used to. I used to work at this restaurant called Brother Jimmy's. I was a hostess, and that was just hard. It's just hard to like work on your art and also be hungry. They say that being hungry helps you as an artist, but I would rather be well-fed and have horrible art.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like a lot of glamorizing of being poor, but it really doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good when you feel sick and you can't go to the hospital because you can't afford the copay. That doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good to skip meals because you can't afford it.
Yeah, and then as you've gone through your 20s, how has your relationship with money changed?
I'm more successful than I was 5 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, for sure. But I definitely don't feel like secure in my money, because if I ever stopped working, that would be it. Like, I have savings, but not enough to really sustain me for more than a year, 2 years. Like, and I don't have, you know, the safety net to fall back on where some other people do, you know. But it makes me into the person I am today, for sure. I'm appreciative of money. I work hard for my money. We're living in like a late stage of capitalism. And you see that in how everyone has become a personal brand. The need to make money and generate wealth is so deep that like everyone has to sell everything all the time. Your side
including
hustle.
Including their personality.
Literally, it's like you're selling your personality. You're selling your tweets, your Instagram. You're putting that on to like try to make a quick buck. But at what expense, you know? It's really intense.
Yeah.
Living in this age, but it's really intense.
Yeah, well, you were doing that for a while, right? Like while you were a hostess, you were also creating.
Yeah, I was tweeting. I was literally Twitter is the reason why I am employed. And Twitter is like, it's tough because woo, what it's done to democracy. Woo. Tough. Tough. But it's like how much black visibility, how many minorities have gained visibility because of this social media website where like the gatekeepers couldn't stop us from being viral and making being ourselves, like literally making jokes. It's like if your joke has 100,000 likes, okay, then this person may be funny, you know, whereas like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, gatekeepers would decide what's funny, what's not.
And when you were tweeting, was that like an intentional decision on your part where you like I need to build my
it
brand.
Wasn't like one day I woke up and I had thousands of followers. Like I was tweeting into the wind for a very long time. But I did that consciously, being like, okay, if I tweet and show my jokes, then maybe eventually like I can get a job, like, and I can be hired for my comedy and for my art. But I did a lot of free labor, and I still do free labor to get my comedy and get my art out there so I can make money off of my art.
Coming up after the break, Ziwe and I get into representation in comedy, imposter syndrome, all that good stuff. Hey, this is Uncomfortable Listeners. I want to introduce you to a podcast that I think you'll love. It's called Adulting. It's about how we're all trying to figure out how to be a grown-up. Each week, comedians Michelle Buteau and Jordan Carlos compare notes with some of the funniest, most creative adults, including Jim Gaffigan, Phoebe Robinson, Kate Walsh, and Vanessa Williams. Plus, they tackle tough questions like, how much should you spend on pillows? And is it okay to eat cereal 3 times a day? Yeah, it is.
Anyway, so subscribe to Adulting wherever you get your podcasts, because nobody, absolutely nobody, knows what they're doing.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Ziwei grew up in a working-class neighborhood in Massachusetts, and as a teenager, she attended Phillips Academy Andover, which is one of the most prestigious boarding schools in the country. We got into how that experience shaped her work. What was Phillips like?
It was just a cultural clash from, like, living in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which is, like, this mill city with, like, a super huge urban population. It's one of the poorest cities in Massachusetts. The majority of people I spoke to on a daily basis were immigrants. And then you're going to, like, a high school where it's, like, super Americana, and, like, your classmates, like, their last name are, like, Washington, because their found their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather literally was George Washington.
Wow.
You know, the songs I like, the things I wore, I was... Like, you have to learn so much, you know. Mm. I learned what Lily Pulitzer was. I wear L.L. Beans now. But these are things I didn't know existed until I went to boarding school.
How did you end up at that school?
Andover High students and, like, Phillips Academy Andover kids would, like, come to Lawrence and, like, teach these underprivileged kids, like, math and English. And then we'd get bussed out to Andover to see, like, a whole new world and, like, opportunity. And we'd learn about, you know, we'd see grass for the first time. Like, not actually, but
right.
That's kind of, like, it was very Freedom Riders. And so I applied, and then I got in, and then, you know, the rest is history. I can put me on the trajectory to be a professional artist, that's for sure.
And in what ways did it feed your art specifically?
Honestly, it made me appreciate where I'm from even more, because because I realized that there's a lot of culture in where I came from. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I could, like, really tap into that had I not seen both sides of that fence. Literally, the grass is greener.
That ability to recognize all the messiness and complications of race and class, and her willingness to make people uncomfortable, is what makes her jokes so smart. Like, she has this one YouTube series called Baited, where she does exactly that. She fools her white friends into saying problematic stuff.
We're going to take a trip down memory lane and see when my guests learned to be racist. Please welcome my white friend, Matt Rogers. So where did you grow up?
I grew up on Long Island.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How many black people live in Long Island?
I would say many black people live on Long Island.
Can you list them all?
No.
Give it a try. It's... Tarek? Malik?
I'm sure there's a Malik.
Wow, that's racist.
It's pretty cringy, but also kind of brilliant. And it's that kind of subversive humor that helped her land a job in late night. I mean, late night has traditionally, in case you didn't know, has been super white and really male. And you're one of a handful of black women comedy writers for late night shows. What is that like, being in this kind of space?
In late night, I worked for Robin Thede, who's a black woman. She employed a lot of, like, strong brown women mm-hmm. at that show. Mm-hmm. And then Desus and Meryl, it's a pretty diverse show as well. So I can't necessarily attest to, like, the how hard it is to be a black woman in this industry. I think it's hard to be a black woman in the world.
Mm.
And I think that late night comedy and entertainment are a reflection of the world we live in. So I don't think that there's the separation between, well, it's really particularly hard to exist. No, that's fundamentally, I'm being discriminated against all the time. That's mm-hmm. just, like, a mm-hmm. fact of the matter. And that wouldn't differ if I worked in late night. That wouldn't differ if I worked at a hospital. That wouldn't differ if I worked in a mine, you know, frankly.
Yeah, totally.
So whenever someone asks me that question, I say it's like real life.
Okay, so then what is it like writing for a show that's run by people of color then?
Fantastic. It's great. My references land, which is nice. I can refer to Kirk Franklin and people know who I'm talking about.
Mm.
That's really nice, you know? I can talk about, like, eating plantains and, like, rice and, like, the things I grew up with, or my parents being really strict and, like, not letting me watch more than an hour of TV, or letting me, like, leave, like, our yard for fear that we'd be abducted by, like, crazy Americans. So, like, having these, like, cultural similarities is so inspiring for my writing, because to hear like Deez and Samero especially, like they reflect the world that I really grew up in Lawrence, Massachusetts. So when they speak, I'm like so excited because I'm like, oh my God, I remember that. And I remember that, these things that I had forgotten years ago, having gone, lived in the Midwest, lived in Andover, like they're all coming back to me like a flood. And this is just like exciting my writing and making, and just giving me so much material to work with.
That's so real. And it's just like also so nice to not have to explain things.
And totally, like, definitely.
Yeah, and to hear people actually relate to what you're saying and affirm it is like a really nice thing.
It's honestly so great. And so I've been lucky enough to have those experiences for my two staff writing jobs in TV. And I hope to create a world like that in the future for other young writers.
Because I feel like so much of this is about representation. It reminds me of when I was in college and I was like, oh, I have to be a doctor or a lawyer. And then I realized that's not what I wanted to do. And I really wanted to pursue journalism or radio. And literally the only reason I did is because there was another Arab American Muslim woman at my school who was doing that. And I remember I just shadowed her for one day. And then the next day I changed my major.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's my story.
Beyonce's Homecoming, she says it like, if you can't see it, you can't be it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you have to see yourself in the world to know that you can even be that person.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's so basic, sure. But it's true.
Totally. Is it basic? Because lots of people get representation. They just may not look like us. Honestly, I think that a big influence of mine was Brandy as Cinderella, the black Cinderella.
Yeah.
And she would sing, in my own little corner. And I was just like in love with this woman. When she had braids too, I was like, oh my God, like I can be a princess. Yeah.
Yeah, those things actually stick with you.
Yeah, they really do. In my own little corner, in my own little chair,
I can be whatever I want to be. As a young writer, do you ever feel like imposter syndrome or anything like that?
All the time.
Mm-hmm. Every day.
I feel like that. I'm like, why are you guys interviewing me? Like, why am I here? No, I feel imposter syndrome totally. But then I remember I work so hard, which is crazy. And so I even feel guilty. I'm like, oh my God, Zoe, like you could be working so much harder. Like, but I work so hard. So whenever I feel imposter syndrome, I'm just like, let me just get back at it and try to like write some more stuff. Or produce something, or do my live show, or write another song, or make a music video. But I think it's human to doubt yourself, but I think you have to catch those moments of doubt and stop and say, hey, you know, wake up. This is the life you live, and you're in this room, and you deserve to be here, and you just have to abide like that. Mm-hmm. That's all you can do is just, like, give yourself positive reinforcement. I've actually been working a lot on positive reinforcement. Something I would recommend to artists is, like, being able to write and create and then leave it. Like, letting go. Because to be precious about your art, ooh, you're in for a hard life. Because your art will get ripped apart. So I would write things and then I just let it go because it's over. I'm onto something new. I have a different project. Mm. And I think that I like that attitude in myself.
I appreciate that.
What I'm
that.
Saying is that I love myself. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What if some days you just don't feel funny?
Yeah, sometimes. So a lot of the time as a comedian, I'll write a joke and be like, that's the last funny joke that I'll ever write. I don't know how I'm going to get another one out there, you know?
Yeah.
You have like a viral tweet, it gets like 100K. You're like, well, that's the last tweet I'll ever do because that's all I got. Like, the well is dry.
Yeah.
But as a professional, your goal is to just like being able to turn over and turn over even when you don't feel like writing, right? Like being a doctor, I would compare comedy to being a surgeon and being able to heal patients even when you don't feel like it. So comedy is like surgery.
Wow. But just a lot less pay.
I'm just kidding. I know, true. That's true. Whoa, drag me. Wow, marketplace, APM. Wow.
But you're poor right now.
You sound like my parents. Yeah, are you Nigerian? Fuck.
I'm going to shift the conversation a little, and I want to play a game with you.
Okay.
We don't have a name for this game yet. I'm going to call it Rapid Fire Questions.
Okay, that's really cool. That's really
very clever. All right, so are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, would you rather win $50,000 for yourself or have your best friend win $500,000?
My best friend is me, so the latter.
Wow. Wow. Okay. I was not expecting that answer.
Sorry.
All right. Would you rather be a multimillionaire, but every time you're on stage, it's like mediocre? Mm-hmm. Or would you rather be a legend and be broke forever?
I think I would rather be a legend, but the idea of being a multimillionaire who's mediocre, that doesn't sound so bad, mm-hmm. honestly.
Okay, what's your cheapest habit?
My cheapest habit, I'm cheap. I'm a cheap person because mm-hmm. I was raised by Nigerian immigrants who taught me the value of a dollar. So my cheapest habit is going on dates that I hate.
Free food?
Just kidding. I didn't do it for the free food. I did it for the company. Mm-hmm. Because when we're here, we're family.
What is the stupidest thing you've done with your money?
The dumbest thing I've done with my money? Go into debt for college.
Yeah, that's real.
That's dumb.
If you were a scammer, what would your scam be?
What would my scam be? Being a professional artist. That's a grift. The idea that people pay me for my words. Woo! Scam.
What's the best money advice that anyone has ever given you?
Don't spend money you don't have. Save money. No, pay off. The best money advice I have. I have a lot of good money advice. The best mm-hmm. money advice I have is to pay off your credit cards every month, because otherwise you're just paying the interest and it's too much.
Mm-hmm. Do you try to pay it off every month, or do you?
I try. Yeah, I don't spend that much of my credit cards. Like Nigerians are very averse to credit because they know that it's like bondage.
Mm.
So,
how much money do you have saved up?
How much money? I don't know. I have no idea. Not enough. That's how much money I have.
Not enough.
Until I have a house and liquid after a house, I don't have any money. To me, money is like being able to like live and create your art and do whatever you want, independent of like having to do this thing to make rent, to make bills.
Quick last few questions, rapid fire. Who would you love to interview?
Who would I love to interview? Michelle and Barack Obama together. Actually, the whole Obama family. Including Bo.
Oh, nice. What's one thing everyone should have no matter what the cost?
Healthcare.
Britney Spears or Beyonce?
That's ridiculous. Obviously, I can't answer that. No. I think Beyonce because she's such an influence, but Britney Spears was my first pop star. So again, I refuse to answer. I don't pick between my pop stars.
Mm-hmm. That's a sensitive
topic. I really
topic.
Don't. Yes, it is. Yeah. Do you want me to get doxxed?
All right, Ziwe, thanks for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun having you here.
Thanks for having me. It was such a pleasure.
All right, that's all for this week's show. If you want to hit us up, you can reach us at uncomfortable@marketplace.org. Let us know what's on your mind. Tell me all of your money secrets, please. This is Uncomfortable is produced by me, Rima Khres, Haley Hirschman, and Peter Balanon-Rosen. Megan Dietry is our senior producer. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Muna Danish is our intern. Charlton Thorpe is our technical director. Satara Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager of Marketplace. And theme music is by Wonderly. All right, catch y'all next week.
The good things that I've created are only because I've created so much bad. Truly, yeah. It's like an iceberg. You only see the tip, but below it, it's melting caps. No, that's sad. Don't laugh at that. That's tragic.
Sorry.
Oh,
sorry.
No, global warming. No, this is not funny.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.